Distributing the Future, broadcast number 7.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
This week, we look at security in a variety of settings. We excerpt the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Cory Doctorow speech on DRM from the recent Euro-OSCON conference and a conversation that Intel's Denise Cooper had with Ben Lowry of the Bunker Secure Hosting and the Apache Software Foundation. We also talked to Andy Oram, book editor with O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is brought to you by Make Magazine, technology on your time. In Volume 4, cool holiday kits, build a cigar box guitar, circuit bending, high-speed flash photography, coffee hacks, and lots of cool DIY music projects. Visit makescene.com. Growing up in a small town, we never locked our house or our car. This made it easy for us kids coming home after school. We just opened the back door and entered. Friends didn't have to wait outside until we got home. They knew they could come in through the back door and help themselves to something to drink while waiting for us to get there. But times changed and there were robberies in the houses around us. My parents decided to start locking the doors and gave us each a key. Adding the simplest level of security inconvenienced us authorized users. It seemed silly to pass out keys to our friends, so they had to wait outside for us or call us on the phone until we answered and then come over. A lock on the door does not protect a house against professional criminals. It's a minimal step against people who are more opportunity criminals. The next step for many home and apartment owners is an alarm system, and some may escalate to surveillance cameras or an on-premises security personnel. You could, of course, brick up all the doors and windows and make it impossible for a robber to enter your home. The downside is you can't enter either. This balance is the same challenge facing those trying to secure computer software and content like music or video. It would be much easier if we didn't have to worry about letting the end user view the content or use the software. Ben Lowry explains.
For computers to be useful, people have to be able to use them, right? So you've got to allow them to do stuff, and you've got to allow them to do stuff that's potentially dangerous. And that means that programs, particularly in the current generation of operating systems, and pretty much all of successful operating systems ever, stuff that they run does stuff on their behalf and therefore can do things that's just as dangerous as what the user can do, you know, manually. And I think that that's one of the reasons that these operating systems are kind of inherently insecure. It's much more about controlling the execution environment locally. So it's much more about I run a program, it wants to read a file, I want to give it permission to read that file, but I don't want to accidentally give it permission to read every other file on the operating system. I want it to read just the file that I gave it to. Now, you can do that with current operating systems, but it's very painful and tedious.
Most of us understand the risks when we install software. We might not have a deep understanding of all that could happen, but we do click past an end-user agreement that promises we can't hold the software company responsible for, you know, damaging our system beyond all recognition. Reading the EULA is somewhere in the realm of flossing daily, eating better, installing security patches. It's all stuff we should do, but somehow we don't always. Installing software is risky. Playing music seems different. Andy Oram's been thinking about the Sony DRM, Digital Rights Management, case. He explains why this case should get our attention.
You don't think of playing a CD as installing software, and much less as altering the operating system so that certain things are going on behind your back.
Securing musical content and videos. How do you do it without bricking over all the doors and windows? I can't sell you a movie on a DVD if I'm not going to let you view it. Cory Doctorow says that the premise of securing these discs and the devices that play them using DRM is not a realistic goal.
DRM is grounded on the idea that you can build a safe so strong that it's safe to leave it in the bank robber's living room.
So what kind of trouble are we protecting against? Andy Oram explains that in the case of Sony, they were trying to keep people from copying their music too many times. Is that such a bad thing?
Let's start with their goals. Their goals were to keep people from making more than 3 copies of any CD. Because once you load a CD in your computer, normally you can make copy after copy after copy. You can either use a second CD tray or you can put it into memory and make copies from there. So Sony was trying to keep people from making only 3 copies, restrict them to making only 3 copies. And this is sort of an interesting taking the law into their own hands, because most people get a sense that there is something okay about making a copy because you might lose the original, or making a copy that you could play in another location. But people get a sense that it's not fair to make hundreds of copies and just give them away to friends. And in fact, copyright law in the United States has an idea of fair use, which tries to give some idea of how many copies and how much of a copy you can make. So fair use is a doctrine that's developed over decades, and it's very complicated. It takes all kinds of things into account, like whether you are threatening the business model of the person who made the CD. That's a very vague and kind of subjective viewpoint. So it's the kind of thing that people have to just decide on their own. And when it goes to court, each court has to decide on the basis of many criteria whether you had a right to make a copy in this particular case or not. So Sony, as I said, was taking the law in their own hands. They said, let's just say that anyone can make 3 copies and that's it. And we won't let you make a 4th copy. So that's kind of strange. And I don't know if it's so unfair. I really can't think of a legitimate reason to make more than 3 copies. But more and more, the CD and DVD manufacturers, the music studios, the movie companies, they're taking the law into their own hands this way. And they're using technology to enforce their idea of what fair use should be. And along the way, they may be cutting out perfectly good uses, like maybe making a small copy of a snippet of something that you could then use to as part of a review or something like that.
That's a very important point. Even if you think that restricting the copying of materials to 3 times is pretty reasonable, restrictions like this amount to taking the law into your own hands. It's easy to start out with reasonable sounding restrictions and end up setting some pretty scary precedents. Cory Doctorow talks about some of the restrictions in the proposed European broadcast flag.
A rights holder using a CPCM system can specify the number of screens you're allowed to watch it on, the number of times you're allowed to watch it, with a time window in which you're allowed to watch it, the distance from the receiver that you're allowed to watch it, and so on and so forth. Most interesting from EFF's perspective, and I think maybe from a lot of Europeans' perspective, is that this is a system that allows a rights holder to say, this video may only be consumed within one household's worth of devices. And on the surface, that sounds like a pretty fair bargain. After all, if what we're arguing about is the right of people to enjoy traditional uses, what's wrong with restricting it to one household? Most of us are accustomed to restricting our media to with one household, or maybe loaning it out to one other household or what have you. The question we need to ask is, what's a household? Well, a household is whatever the technology says it is. So we're moving from a world where household is a word that has a complex social, legal, and religious meaning to something where household is something that has an exact technical meaning defined by the entertainment industry. We're moving from a world where copyright allows you to specify who can copy your movie to a world where copyright is a thing that allows you to specify what a family is. And that's a pretty amazing sea change for us to be in the middle of.
Wait a minute. How did we get from reasonable restrictions like not copying a disc too many times to a situation in which we're defining what a family is? Let's back up a minute and think about what we might be trying to secure against. Content providers want to protect against people copying and sharing these files that contain their property. Another danger, of course, is that holes in security allow viruses and worms to wreak havoc on a computer. In the Sony case, it was their attempts to secure their content that opened up holes that allowed viruses to attack unsuspecting music lovers. Ben Laurie explains the difference between viruses and worms.
What a virus does is typically it relies on, for propagation, on persuading people somehow to execute some piece of bad software. So send an email and say, double click on the extension. So a worm, essentially the same thing, is, persuade some other machine to run some piece of bad software, but a different path into it. Worms don't use humans in their propagation, and viruses typically do.
So we're back to protecting machines against the people who need to use them. If you're securing a transmission, then the model is simple. I need to send a message to you. You need to be able to receive it. And someone in the middle should get something that's, not readable. This is what you think is happening when you make a purchase over the internet. Imagine what changes if you put copy protection on your audio CD. Now you sell that CD to someone and they can listen to it, but the security prevents them from copying it. In other words, the person you're protecting against is the person you're selling the CD to. Cory Doctorow explains.
DRM is a security system. And in every security system, you have one or more senders, one or more receivers, and one or more attackers. And the objective of the system is to allow the senders and the receivers to communicate securely without the attacker disrupting the communication, and in some instances, without even knowing that communication is taking place. And since more or less World War II, all security has been based on the idea that everyone, the attacker, the sender, and the receiver, know about the cipher and how it works, because science involves publishing. And if you don't publish the cipher and how it works, you don't know whether or not it's indeed secure. Everyone knows that the message exists and can probably capture a copy of the message, because the message is being sent around on a public network, whether that's free space electromagnetic transmissions over the airwaves or over a public network like the internet. And what the attacker and the receiver share, or what the sender and the receiver share that the guy in the middle doesn't share, that the attacker doesn't have, is the key, right? There's one secret, the smallest secret possible, because secrets are hard to keep. The smaller you make them, the easier they are to keep. Well, in a DRM system, you've got a different world. You've got an attacker, and you've got a sender. The attacker is the intended recipient of the message. I sell you a DVD with the expectation that you will, under some circumstances, be able to convert the encrypted video on the DVD into a decrypted video so that you can watch it. If I don't provide you with that mechanism, you won't buy the DVD. A DVD with an encrypted video on it that you can't decrypt is a useless video. So DRM is a system that treats the owner of the media that it delivers to as the attacker of the system. So it's a system that necessarily requires that owners of equipment not be able to modify, service, understand, or improve on their own equipment.
Hold on a minute. Now, in order for a company to keep us from copying a CD too many times, they're going to modify and restrict the equipment we run it on. For Andy Oram, this is where the Sony story got even worse. You bought an operating system from Microsoft, and the music CD you're playing actually changes some of the code that Microsoft sold you.
After we talked about what Sony wanted to do, what their goals were, now the question is, how do they carry out their goals? And that is where it gets really kind of disgusting. Because copy protection in this case meant that they had to delve deep, deep into the operating system and make sure that very basic things the system does when it moves bits around, and they could check and see whether the bits they were moving were their bits. So if you're trying to copy something from a CD, Sony would know about it and be able to make a mark on there and figure out whether you were copying more than three times. So they had to actually change some of the code of the Windows operating system. They were really changing what Microsoft had given you, and they did it in a fairly sloppy way. So if you tried to reverse what they were doing, you might remove important stuff from your system, or you might crash the system. And then they did things to hide this. They gave things funny names, and certain things show up when you look at your list of running processes on the system. So a moderately sophisticated user would see things that showed what Sony had done, but they were given innocuous names, so they looked like it was just a service to you. So Sony certainly didn't want people to know what they were doing. Finally, when they were discovered, they said, okay, if you want to remove this, you can, but they put together something rather quickly, and it's got security flaws in it, so that there are actually viruses circulating now on the internet that can exploit your system thanks to the program that's supposed to remove the program that was not supposed to be there anyway.
So now, by listening to some Sony music on your Windows box, you've ended up with a computer that's more susceptible to viruses. Cory Doctorow channels Eric Raymond to make an analogy from alchemy about why openness is important.
For 500 years, we had alchemy. Alchemy was a lot like chemistry, except you didn't publish your results. So for 500 years, every alchemist discovered the hard way that drinking mercury was bad for you. And they never published it, so everyone had to discover it their own way. Then one alchemist published his work. And 100 years later, the Enlightenment had finished. We had gone from a 500-year dark age into an age of what has been uninterrupted technological and social progress as a result of sharing knowledge instead of hoarding knowledge. Open source is important as a social phenomenon.
Ben Lurie has thought quite a bit about how holes in security are exposed and exploited, and the differences between open and closed source as breeding grounds for exploits.
Security holes, in my experience, are not found because people closely examine code and go, oh, I found a security hole. They're usually found because they do something stupid and it dies. And they go, oh, I managed to kill it. Killing it shouldn't be allowed to, it shouldn't be possible, right? So if I can kill it, then there's a bug in there which is potentially exploitable. And whether it's open source or closed source at that point doesn't matter, because once you've found a route to killing it, you can look at the assembler if it's closed source, or you can look at the source if it's open source, and they're about equally useful to a decent hacker. And actually, there's a similar criticism, which is that in open source, when you fix a security hole, it's very apparent what you've done to fix the security hole, because people can look at the patch to the source, and they can go, oh yeah, so that was the bug that he fixed, and it's clear what the bug was and how it worked, and so now I can go and write an exploit for that. But actually, people do this on closed source as well. I mean, a friend of mine, Halvar Flake, not his real name, but one of the things he does is binary difference analysis of Microsoft patches, and he can produce an exploit for a Microsoft fix in under an hour, typically, which is actually probably faster than using the source. Closed source vendors have this feeling that they're less vulnerable and can take less care and get away with it because they think that their programs are less easily inspected and therefore less easily exploited if there are vulnerabilities in it. And so I think one of the reasons that you see more attacks on proprietary software is because there are more security holes in it. But it's not clear that that's the long-term trend. I mean, there's a lot of security holes in open source as well. And there is this idea, you know, many eyes and all that stuff, which I don't really believe in from my experience, you know, because the holes in OpenSSL that I found have been there for, I don't know, at least 10 years.
A benefit of open source, however, is that once a hole is found and patched, the patch can be distributed fairly quickly. Ben Lurie has discovered and patched a hole in OpenSSL, but that wasn't the end of the story.
The OpenSSL worm, which resulted from a bunch of security holes in OpenSSL that I found doing work that was funded by DARPA. And a month after I announced the patches, somebody developed a worm that exploited one of the security holes that I'd patched, and something like 50% of servers were vulnerable. And I thought that was irritating.
Why don't people apply their patches?
For a number of reasons. I think that back then, because this was a number of years back now, people were more cautious and actually just less informed about applying patches and why it was important. But there's also the reason that they're not necessarily getting their software directly, so the patch may not actually be available to them. So, you know, a lot of people are using in the case of OpenSSL, say they're not using the version of OpenSSL that the OpenSSL team distribute, they're using some packaged version that somebody else distributes. And if that somebody else doesn't get their act together and go through their quality control and all the other crap that they do to package fast enough, then the patch isn't going to be available to these people. And, you know, the contrast between the one-day turnaround that we can achieve in Apache and the turnaround times of people who do packaging, which could be, you know, weeks or even months. I mean, even, you know, I said working with big closed-source companies, they can take 3 months or even longer to turn around a patch. But we get the same thing with, you know, if we're trying to coordinate with packages for OpenSSL, they always ask for at least 30 days, which, you know, I'm okay with giving them if it's not a known bug, but, you know, it's kind of sad that we could do it in one day and we have to give them 30. The really easy answer is don't package. Submit improvements to the base code, so when somebody downloads it and compiles it on your platform, it's the way you want it, because the base code is the way you want it. So you don't have to have packages.
So this brings us back to the flossing each day scenario. You can put locks on your door, but if you don't use them, they'll do you no good. Once a hole is patched, you need to get and install the patch. Okay, let's get back to the Sony case. Suppose you decide it's reasonable to restrict a CD to be copied only 3 times. How would you do this? Andy Oram says you end up having to be pretty intrusive. It's like someone securing your house by moving in with you, tasting your food, sleeping in your bedroom, and so on.
You have to do all this if you just want to keep people from making 4 copies of something. Say that Sony did have a legitimate reason to keep people from making hundreds of copies of their CDs. How could they do this without being so intrusive? And it seems like you have to be pretty intrusive. You have to change the whole system and because people can run other operating systems, you even have to change the hardware so that it won't let you put on an untrusted operating system. Untrusted in this case means that a system that Sony doesn't trust. When we talk about trusted computing in this particular situation, we mean a system that Sony can trust so that they know that you're not copying CDs without their permission. The movement of trusted computing is something that involves the chip manufacturers, the people who make BIOS or other boot programs on the system. It involves the operating system, it involves the applications, it goes all the way up the stack, as they say. Everything that you touch has to be somehow validated. And if anything goes, if anything is left out of this scheme, then that leaves a hole. And it means that people might be able to install programs that would let them make copies, would let them change things perhaps on their system. Furthermore, if there was a hole in the system, somebody would be able to figure out how to exploit it, just like they're writing viruses now. And someone could post a program, say on the internet, that would let everybody, even unsophisticated people, break the copy protection. So it's a very—it's kind of a fortress mentality. Everything has to be in place, and any chink in the armor could be a major vulnerability.
That's a lot to make sure works together. There are a lot of places that the system can be attacked. Suppose the system is attacked. We've seen cases where the attacker is prosecuted. Ben Laurie addresses the issue of punishing hackers.
I think that that hacking computers is a bad thing that you shouldn't do. But on the other hand, I think it's interesting that there's this big imbalance between the hackers and the people who are responsible for creating vulnerable software in the first place. You see hackers go to prison, but you never see anybody getting fined for producing crap software. You know, whereas if I build a bridge and the bridge fell down and killed people, I'd be in trouble, right? But if I write a piece of software that loses companies millions of pounds because it gets hacked, then everyone goes, oh, well, you know.
So you think software...
bug, that's inevitable, you know.
So you think software should be warranted? Do you think that that's...
Well, I don't know what the answer to that is, because obviously that would be bad for open source, and I also think open source is a good idea. So I don't know what the answer is. I think it's an interesting thing that there is this asymmetry there, but I'm not sure that the answer is that all software authors should be responsible for the security of their software.
So it's a bit of an arms race trying to secure and break various restrictions. Does all this armor actually encourage honest folks to become criminals? Cory Doctorow says yes.
DRM is not copyright, nor is it copyright protection. DRM drives users to eschew legitimate mechanisms for acquiring copyrighted works, e.g. buying DVDs in shops, to using darknet technologies that are largely infringing to acquire their copies, because those copies have had the DRM broken off of them. If you want a region-free copy of a movie, that is not to say an infringing copy, but a region-free copy, or one that you can move from your home theater to your phone, you can't do that with the one in the shop. In order to do that, you have to become someone who downloads movies using BitTorrent from the internet. So DRM doesn't protect copyright. The other reason DRM doesn't protect copyright is every copyright system in the world contains flexibilities for the public interest. These flexibilities hinge on non-computable factors. They say, for example, that people are allowed to take excerpts from copyrighted works for the purpose of criticizing them. Well, why do we have that? Well, we have that because if you were to say that copyright law requires you to get permission before you can quote something in order to criticize it, most people would withhold the permission. Now, copyright law says that you're allowed to do things like sample the news in order to talk about the way that it's discussing the issues of the day. DRM is not something that's coherent with that copyright law. DRM is something that rewrites the copyright law to create a new suite of rights for rights holders, something that has nothing to do with what the copyright law, in fact, permits and restricts.
There's a certain point in all of this discussion where our eyes glaze over and all we hear is blah, blah, blah. Copyright this, fair use that, U.S. code something else. What if I just want to listen to this CD or watch that movie? Maybe I'm willing to agree when I buy a CD that I won't copy it four times. Corey explains that when there's a definite transaction, that could be reasonable for you to waive some of your rights. But what about when you're watching television? Some networks or programs might have different restrictions. When do you actually agree to these restrictions?
When did you enter an agreement to waive your fair use or fair dealing rights to use this program in exchange for the program itself. Well, I asked someone from the motion picture industry about this. I said, when do I enter into an agreement to waive some of my rights to watch a show? And he said, well, you waive it when you change the channel, right? You form an agreement by going channel up. Well, that's a funny kind of contract, but the contract gets funnier still, because every one of these DRM systems has something built into it called renewability. Renewability is a euphemism for revocability. What it means is that remotely they can revoke features in your device that were present when you bought it. And so you buy a device that does 10 things and tomorrow it does 9 things. You buy a device and you enter into a contract to waive certain rights in exchange for other rights. And then the next day, there are more rights that you've waived without knowing it. The device has been field updated without your permission. PSP this has happened to. This happened with the TiVo, where they installed this MacroVision feature on it and so on. So it's a very, very curious kind of contract. It's a contract that makes EULAs look positively fair by comparison.
And that brings us back roughly to where we started. Thanks to Cory Doctorow of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Ben Lowry of the Apache Software Foundation and Director of Security for the Bunker Secure Hosting, Andy Oram, Book Editor for O'Reilly Media, and Denise Cooper, Senior Director of Open Source Programs for Intel and Secretary and Treasurer of the OSI. You'll find more information in our show notes at OReillyNet.com/future. We are beta-ing this new show in public so that we can benefit from your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com or phone our listener line at 206-350-0383. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettina for composing and performing this theme music. Visit David's website at www.batmosphere.com. David also edits the O'Reilly digital audio site at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Skype, Audio Hijack Pro, and Bias Peak.